Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and we've got a different program today. This is the beginning of the year of 2016, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science has an interesting magazine called Science. But every year, they make a sort of an analysis over what they consider, with public input, the best breakthroughs in science for the previous year. And so my co-host, Russ Chianelli, this week, and we've got two experts to go through some of these advances as determined by science and the lay public. The first one, it's called the CRISPR process. And it sounds like, you know, a good way to get bacon, but it's not. It's got to do with something totally different. And we've got two experts. We've got Professor Charlotte Vines from the Department of Biological Sciences and Dr. Colin Bill, also from the Department of Biological Sciences here at the university. And they're going to explain this to us. So Charlotte and Colin, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Thank you indeed.
CRISPR. What is CRISPR?
Well, it actually stands for quite a mouthful. That's one of the reasons why we tend to call it CRISPR. It actually stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats.
And you had to read that.
Well,
I know you're an expert in it, but I understand then why CRISPR.
Know, I don't want to screw it up.
Right, absolutely.
So obviously it is normally just referred to as CRISPR, and it's also sometimes called CRISPR-Cas9 because it's this CRISPR part of the molecule which is attached to a associated endonuclease called Cas9. And endonuclease is a particular enzyme that can cut DNA.
So this is a technology that can take a regular double-stranded DNA and effectively snip it like a pair of scissors where you choose. Is that what I understand?
That is the key part of the technology. I mean, we've always been able to cut DNA. I mean, obviously, the DNA is very large. But having a mechanism where you can go into the DNA, scan the DNA, find a particular gene or part of a gene that you want to change, and this is where the CRISPR technology comes in.
And the article says it's genome editing technology.
That's exactly right.
So why do we want to edit the genome?
So there's sometimes multiple reasons why you want to edit genomes. From our perspective, most of our editing comes in where we're interested in stopping the expression of a certain protein. So just as Keith mentioned, you can cut the DNA. And when you cut the DNA, the cell doesn't know often if you cut both strands, the cell doesn't know how to fix that because it's just like having two pieces of rope hanging. It doesn't know exactly how to fix it. So you can edit the cell's ability to repair that DNA by using another piece of DNA that says exactly how you want it to be repaired.
So let me get this. If, for example, and I think this is one of the potential uses, if you have a genome which makes you predisposed for sickle cell anemia, then you can go in, cut the DNA in the middle of that sequence which is responsible for sickle cell anemia, or do you just snip it out in both portions? Go into the sort of the what I call the nitty-gritty details.
Right. So it's one of the globin chains are responsible for sickle cell anemia, and it's a mutation within the globin gene. So what you can do is you can cut that gene, and then you can put what in science we call a template. So it tells the cell how to repair that gene, and that's repaired by a process called homology-directed repair. And what will happen is when you cut the gene, the cell's DNA will break into single strands, and they'll match with the part that you're trying to
insert. So you're you're not cutting something out per se. You're just clipping, and it doesn't matter where in this sequence of the gene that you cut.
So normally you cut
something else is going to come in and replace, well, not replace, to add on to.
To repair. So you can cut, you can do one of two things. In our lab, we're cutting and we're just hoping that the cut that we make is poorly repaired and it disrupts the expression. That's one way you can do the
oh, I see.
Yeah, which happens quite often, by the way, because a double strand break, we didn't actually cover this, but if it's not repaired, it's going to be lethal to a cell. It's a lethal event, even one single double strand break. So the idea that you can use this system to target where you want to put a double strand break, and you can put that break in, and then essentially you're relying on the natural repair processes of the cell. then one thing that it can actually do, one thing it can do is just glue it back together and form a completely normal piece of DNA.
So that's but then you're back to square one.
Square one. But, of course, then you've got the same system where you can cut it again. So, but eventually what happens is, in many cases, either those small insertions or sometimes little pieces of DNA are chopped away, and then it rejoins. And so we have what's called insertions and deletions, or sometimes it's just abbreviated to indels. And now you've changed the total sequence of that gene. So now you've disrupted that gene. And so if before it made a functional protein, it now no longer makes a functional protein. So it's one way of so-called knocking out that gene function.
So that leads then to the possibility that once you've done this, and let's say that you've done the cutting, the snipping, and you've now introduced a new segment, which is going to have totally new properties for that genome. This is the wave of the future. I want blue eyes, my children, that will go and do something and snip in the blue gene.
Yes, it's certainly technically possible. I mean, this is the big issue. I mean, we've been able to manipulate genes before, but the real breakthrough and why this CRISPR technology is what it is in the Science magazine is because it's relatively easy to do and it's relatively efficient. So you have a way of using this what's called a guided RNA, that can go in, find the sequence you want, and bring this enzyme right there to where you want it to actually cut. So it's in theory, yes. I mean,
and one of the examples that they have here, too, is building a resistance to cancer, like melanoma. We're not resistant to it.
Well, that's down the future. I mean, nobody's really
been able to do it, but that's a target.
Well, one of the problems there is that we don't understand all of the contributing factors that lead to melanoma. So you'd have to understand fully how melanoma develops in order to be able to target the genes that you want to change in order to eliminate the possibility of developing the melanoma. We don't
so that's
have
a
that.
Long way down the pike.
I don't know if it's a long way down the pike because, I mean, we talk about cutting or altering, or in fact, with this CRISPR technology, instead of just cutting the DNA, there's been manipulations that have been made where the Cas9 is actually made inactive, which sounds kind of a strange thing to do, but then you can tag on other proteins. So in some cases, you can actually activate your genes of interest or repress them. So there's ways of not just cutting, but a ways of manipulating down or manipulating up. But what they're doing also, and I just want going back to your melanoma question here, where you might have to target a whole bunch of genes, is there are CRISPR libraries. So you can actually go in there and target a number of genes at the same time. So it's not necessarily hitting one gene at one time. In theory, you can hit a lot of genes a lot of times. So you're right. I mean, we might be seeing some very interesting papers.
One of the points to me that was interesting is we have natural resistance to certain diseases in our system, but we don't to cancers. And the idea was that we could build these resistance to cancers by using this technology in the future.
So one of the problems with that approach, and they could very well do that, so I'm not negating the idea, but one of the problems is just what Dr. Bill mentioned. The CRISPR-Cas9 relies on something called a guide. And that guide is trying to target and find a very specific piece of DNA. But what if it hits something that mismatches by one nucleotide? That's called off-target effects.
Collateral damage.
Collateral damage.
That's one way of talking about it, isn't
and
it?
So yeah, if you're sending in CRISPRs that are targeting four or five different genes that you find contribute to melanoma, and each one of these has potential off-target effects, are you causing more damage than you're causing repair?
So we got to understand this is still a very early three-year-old technology.
Yes.
Let's just, for the list and for myself, a lot of research is directed, right? The National Cancer Institute gives millions of dollars to go and do a specific, well-focused concept. I gather this particular CRISPR technology came out of some serendipitous findings by different research groups. It wasn't directed research, and I think that's important to let the people know. Can you give us a quick history in a minute?
So we were actually fortunate enough to hear Dr. Doudna speak at the American Society of Cell Biology in San Diego.
That's right.
And what she described was that a friend of hers or a colleague had made an observation about these regularly interspaced palindromic repeats that were found in bacteria. And she was simply trying to understand how they got there. And based on this, they found out it was the bacteria's way. It's an adaptive immune system, if you will. And when I say adaptive, it means it changes in response to an infection of the bacteria. So they weren't looking to modify DNA. They weren't looking to modify genomes. They were trying to figure out why these repeats were present in bacteria. And they found out it was the bacteria's immune system. And by the by, this technology came out.
If I've got that correct, this is rather like tree rings, right? That you can look at the DNA of this bacteria and see what it's been subjected to over its history. Yeah. I mean,
that's right. What they found actually was then little pieces of viral DNA that were between these regular palindromic sequences in the bacteria. And then it turns out, as Dr. Vines explained, what happens is that next time they're infected by a bacteriophage virus, it recognizes that DNA, and then through this CRISPR technology of the bacteria, it's able to go cut the DNA and destroy it.
Very quickly, Charlotte, what are you doing with this technology in your own research lab?
So we're interested in studying how we can knock out a gene that normally sends T-cell acute lymphocytic leukemias into the brains of children. The problem there is when
there's a gene that will transport
it sends
into the brain.
T-cell leukemia into the brain. The problem is when the T-cells move into the brain, the normal systemic chemotherapies that are used to treat leukemia no longer can get to these cells. They hide in the brain. So we want to stop these cells from moving into the brain. We can block the gene, block their movement into the brain. The cells stay in the periphery, and now the drugs can actually kill the leukemia.
And so I get the point that Colin said earlier. This is a relatively cheap, facile technology, and research using this is going to be sprouting up all over the place. Well, this is a fascinating area, and I worry about things like this, the future of manipulating ourselves. The Economist had a front page on this, editing humanity. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. We're here with co-host this week, Russ Chianelli, Colin Bill from the Department of Biological Sciences, and Charlotte Vines, also talking about CRISPR. And this was work that was discovered by two lady scientists, one in California, Jennifer Doudna, and the other, Emmanuel Charpentier in France. And Nobel Prize is just down the road, I think.
It looks like
well,
it.
I would expect so, yeah.
We'll be back in one moment. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli. And we're doing the sort of a summary of what was best in science in 2015. And now we've come to what is sort of coming under the bailiwick of reproducibility in psychology. And I'm going to read you the first paragraph from this science article. This year caps a transformation for psychological science. The field was mired in scandal just a few years ago, but a band of revolutionaries is turning psychology into a beacon for scientific reproducibility. Now, that sounds enormously important. We have in the studio today to discuss this breakthrough finding Professor Larry Cohen from the Department of Psychology at UT El Paso. And Larry, welcome, and what an introduction. What a beautiful first paragraph.
Well, thanks very much for the introduction. And it was a very interesting paragraph. In some ways, I think, at the risk of being a contrarian, this is old news. For many, many years, behavioral scientists have been concerned about the variability in research findings from one study to another. And with that variability comes the difficulty of integrating research findings and reaching some general conclusion about any particular relationship that you're studying. This has been studied for at least since the mid-1970s, although frankly, it's as old as Pearson when he was trying to integrate findings regarding the efficacy of a typhoid vaccine in combating a typhoid among British soldiers in India over 100 years ago. This was around 1904. So the issue's been around for a very long time. How do you integrate research findings, multiple findings from multiple studies that have used different samples, when the findings themselves often are not identical? This particular report that was just published is notable in part because of the attention it's drawn to the issue and the massive undertaking that it involved, 100 studies. These researchers identified quasi-randomly 100 studies from several of the leading journals in the behavioral sciences, and then identified colleagues who would in those areas who would seek to replicate the studies almost in exact form. They got the same materials from the original authors whenever possible. And so you had 100 studies with a couple of hundred researchers seeking to replicate the findings.
So for each study, maybe two or three groups?
No, for each study, there was one group. There were a pair of researchers.
Okay, so it's one single replication.
If I remember the article correctly. The reason this attracted a lot of attention is the following. Only about 38% of the study findings were replicated. We'll come back to that in a moment, but a lot of people paused and were somewhat concerned about that. In addition, the effect sizes, the magnitude of the relationships that were reported in the original study were halved in the follow-up study. So the strength of the relationship was half as great.
Right. So it still sounds pretty scary.
Well, actually, it turns out it's not. And the reason for that is the following. You don't expect in a sample that you've drawn, let's say, randomly from the population – that sample is going to deviate in terms of its characteristics from what the population will really look like. That's the nature of the beast because you don't have everybody in your sample. You have a small random sample. And often the studies themselves were based on small samples. And as a consequence, no one really expects that a single study is going to serve as the gold standard, as the anchor for your estimate of the true population effect size. It's your best estimate. That first study is your best estimate of what the true population effect size is, but it's a crappy estimate. It's based on one study. Now, there's a technique that's been developed since the mid-1970s called meta-analysis. And meta-analysis involves a set of statistical procedures for combining findings from multiple studies that are addressing the same issue. In fact, in this article you were talking about in Science, where they mentioned the reproducibility issue or difficulty in the behavioral sciences, they refer to this meta-analytic technique that they themselves used in this process. And what meta-analysis does, in a way, is try and get rid of the noise from one study, two studies, three studies, or many more studies. And from this standpoint, in a way, the issue of reproducibility is at least 30, 35 years old in terms of attracting an enormous amount of attention in the behavioral sciences. And if I might add, this is not an issue that is restricted to the behavioral sciences. A few years ago, a well-known researcher at one of the big, I believe it was pharmaceutical companies, reported that 47 of the 53 initial studies, findings that had led to the potential of additional research to develop new pharmaceuticals failed to be replicated, 47 out of 53. Now, that's in the so-called hard sciences. So I think the issue of reproducibility has plagued all areas of research.
So then what was the big breakthrough this year?
Well, I was trying to figure out what the big breakthrough was when I read that article. And I think the big breakthrough in part
you did
was,
say it was old news, so
well,
to a certain extent.
Yeah. For people who are familiar with meta-analysis, and frankly, it swept through medicine, it swept through the behavioral sciences, it swept through environmental science. The same technique is used in physics and I believe actually in areas of chemistry when they summarize various research findings. I think the fact that people took 100 studies and tried to replicate these from the leading journals is what really attracted attention. But again, there's no reason to expect that your first study, first of all, is going to be the gold standard. What's really interesting is that subsequent studies reported half the effect size. Now, that is interesting. And I think maybe that reflects something about the rigor with which an initial laboratory may undertake a study. Maybe it reflects bias.
Maybe just the researchers get carried away when they begin to see the glimmer of a new result and they become less critical about the data they're collecting.
No. In principle, that shouldn't be because you don't look at your data until after you've completed the study.
That's different. We look at the data as we're doing it because that drives the next experiment.
Well, frankly, that has been one of the concerns, that when you look at the data and you've collected, let's say, two-thirds of your sample, what you had proposed, and you say, well, now the findings support what I had proposed and hypothesized, I might as well stop here. You don't know what the remaining sample would have shown.
Does that happen very often?
Well, I don't think it happens in a deceitful way. I think it may happen unintentionally where people say, well, we might as well stop now. We found what we thought we were going to find, and there's no point in spending the next 2 months collecting additional data. But I don't think it's deceitful, but it certainly is not good policy.
So one of the interesting conclusions from this particular article in Science was that certain of the editors of psychological journals are beginning to say, well, from now on, I think that publication of direct replications of research results will be a fairly routine occurrence. That's interesting. I mean, I would never think of ever in the area that I work in of trying to publish a paper that says, oh, that paper in 1984 was spot on.
Yeah, actually, that's been a big problem for the discipline because in behavioral sciences, just like in your area, it's been very hard to publish replications because they're not novel and they don't seem to introduce any innovation into the field. The problem is it's replication that really lies at the heart of research
advances.
What
about this process that's in the article about pre-registration, where
right.
you publish an article about what you're going to do?
Right. Yeah, so they have several very important suggestions, and I think maybe this is why it's going to be a turning point in behavioral sciences and maybe some other areas. It's important to first establish the number of participants that your research design, and so people know if you stopped earlier or not. It's important to establish what your hypotheses were in advance so that you don't acknowledge those, so that you don't post hoc begin to highlight what you found and leave aside what you didn't find, even though that may not have been your main hypothesis. And there's a transparency where you can upload all of your data so people can begin to look at it. And all of that makes a lot of sense. And by the way, in medicine, they have registries now. There's a Cochrane collaboration coming out of Britain, worldwide collaboration, where in medical research, people register their studies and their samples so that other folks are aware of the database, the initial hypotheses, and if they want to do subsequent analyses, it's available. It's a very powerful worldwide collaboration in medicine called the Cochrane Collaboration, named after Archie Cochrane.
So, I mean, that's interesting because I remember when my kids were younger, all these damn science competitions that they entered from Mesita, El Paso High, Wiggs, you name it, local high schools and elementary schools. And there was always this tremendous demand to make sure you wrote down your hypothesis. Right? And I'm thinking to myself, that isn't always the way that science is done. Right? Sometimes you'll do an experiment. Russ will agree with this, I'm sure. Because, you don't know quite what's going to happen. You don't have a hypothesis. It's more exciting than having a hypothesis because you've got no clue. But you want to do the experiment? The hypothesis is, I suppose, no one's done this, we'll do it.
Right.
And in your area, though, that wouldn't be quite the same thing.
It's a yes and a no. There's some studies that are conducted like that. The problem there is you can run many analyses and come up with a finding just by chance alone. So to go back to your original issue, though, in terms of publishing studies that seek to replicate a finding, in the absence of that, there's no way to build any scaffolding towards some final understanding of a phenomena. One study alone will not answer a question.
So I've got an idea. Yes. Maybe when you put in your proposals to NIH, NI Mental Health, and all these other institutions, there should be somewhere in there that says, look, for every three papers that you publish, you've got to go and replicate some other work. You choose it, all right? So that, in fact, this begins built in to the ether, right? That, okay, I've published 12 papers last year, let's say. But I've got to now spend some of the time in my laboratory with my group replicating things so that everybody gets into that feeling. I think this is a novel idea.
That's a really interesting idea. I'm not sure that I would be so bold to make that recommendation, but if I can say one more thing about this, in terms of publications, if journals and researchers themselves only publish significant findings and don't bother with the replications, then what you end up with is a potentially biased sample of findings. And that's what these authors were in the reproducibility project were worried about. And this is well known again back in the 1970s, as far back as then. It's known as the file drawer problem. How many studies are tucked away in the file drawers of researchers that did not yield significant findings, never made it into print, either because the journal won't publish it or the author himself or herself thinks I shouldn't send it off. And therefore, if we just look at the findings in published findings in journals, it tilts the balance in a misleading direction. Now, there's a way of addressing that and using these meta-analytic techniques.
Well, also the internet. I mean, people can put sorts of results out there
under their own name
on their own website, picked up.
Right, exactly.
It's interesting. Russell, do you have a concluding thought?
Well, it seems to me that this type of discussion has got a lot of character of politics and so on in it. It's very, very dangerous. If you're a scientist, reproduce the results and publish it.
You've raised, I think, indirectly a very important issue, and that involves the social dimensions of research and science. And people have a desire to publish for many reasons. One is just curiosity and inquisitiveness. Another is to advance in their own professional career. So there are all sorts of dynamics that take place in the area of research that I think most of us often are not schooled in. But your comment, I think, raises an important issue that also is picked up in this reproducibility paper, and that is the need to socialize researchers into what people believe is an increasingly important part of research and science, and that is transparency and reproducibility and replication.
Amen. But Larry, as usual, it's always interesting listening to you.
Well, thanks very much.
You know, you think very nicely about issues.
And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
More than that, even. Thank you to the audience out there for listening. Next week, we'll be back with another Science Studio where we'll be looking at some of the advances in geochemistry and also vaccine development for Ebola. So you'll be there next week. Bye-bye.